And right now, it is time to bring in David Tarachuk with the Media Beat. David joins us on a Friday morning. We broadcast him on the weekend and also, I do believe, on Monday during the noontime hour. David has his own website, themediabeat.us. He is a PBS television correspondent. He reports on ethics and belief. And I do believe he's joining us mile high this morning. No, I mean actually mile high, because I do believe he's out in the Rockies. Good morning, David.
Good morning. Yes, indeed. I don't want to sound superior, but I'm broadcasting to you from about... I'm not sure if it's really a mile high, between 8,000 and 9,000 feet high, which is, you know, impressive. And I'm amongst impressive scenery. I always get totally awed by the mountains here. And I saw a harvest moon overnight, tinges of orange around it over Mount Sopris, just south of Aspen, just southwest of Aspen, and it is a delightful, delightful, inspiring sight.
Yeah, it's what makes getting up early in the morning worth it. Okay.
Well, I'm not sure about that. You know, I'm never a great early riser, and of course, here in the mountains, it's 5:36, not 7:36. So I can, you know, it cuts both ways.
All right. So now,
no, but I'm really glad to be joining you. It's a wonderful place for me. It's elevating in just about every sense of the word, and it's clear air, and I get that break from the incessant media obsessions of the East Coast, and I get a chance to just revel in nature and simple things for a little while.
Well, I give a couple questions on a couple different stories at a couple different locations. First of all, before we get to my questions about Boris Johnson and Brexit, what is Paris is kind of stymied and shut down right now because there's a strike over pensions in Paris right now?
Essentially over pensions, yeah. The pension system in France generally is extremely complicated, and President Macron is determined to simplify it and in many ways make it less of a what many, certainly many in America, would regard as a really, really soft option, a cushy kind of life for French people, working people. I'm not going to pass judgment on that. I think in many ways it is a remarkable social provision in France, and in many ways it's very admirable, but nobody can say that it's simple. And Macron is trying to make it simple and attempting to, you know, trim some of the most expensive parts of it. And in fact, it probably wouldn't be unfair to say that the Paris metro system has some of the most remarkable provisions that they want to hold on to very dearly. But the reformers, epitomized by Macron himself, saying that, well, you know, the ability to retire at 52, which some Paris metro drivers have, is a little over generous and could be scaled back a bit. And the response of the metro drivers, of course, is to say, no, we want to hold on to our benefits. And that's why, of all the places where protests has been bubbling up against this overhaul, the Paris metro system is the core of the strongest protest. And it's not the entire metro system that's closed down, but enough to make it really difficult to get around the capital city right now. So, yeah, Macron's running. I mean, it was always going to happen. He was never going to have an easy time. And we know that, you know, much of his somewhat high-handed approach to policy gets French people's backs up. I mean, the Gilets jaunes, who we saw through the summer, are an example of how, you know, he's not going to get an easy pass for any of his radical reforms.
All right, so now let's go back to the B word, Brexit.
Must we? Well, it's, I suppose we must.
Yeah. It is Brexit, but it isn't. But what's interesting is that by members of the Parliament or what, trying to show that Boris Johnson lied to the Queen. That's a new one to me, but it appears to be a fairly important question that it can only be answered by the courts, right?
Well, interesting. I don't know how interesting people find it, but some of the unprecedented shifts that have been taking place over recent days is something that's very familiar in America, but not so familiar, in fact, hardly familiar at all in Britain, which is to thrash out political differences when you get into an impasse through the court system. That doesn't often happen in Britain. And it's and of course, you know, as it was with everything concerning Brexit, it's not simple. There are various. There have been various moves in the courts to block Boris Johnson's or Bojo to use Jill's favorite abbreviation to stop the Prime Minister in his headlong rush towards what appears to be a headlong rush towards crashing out of Europe without a deal. And terms that will make the exit orderly. In fact, we're moving fast towards a very disorderly exit. But the court effort is in different parts of the country, and the most remarkable one is the action by politicians and campaigners of other sorts too, going to the Scottish High Court, and that gets us into the whole area of how Scottish law is actually a separate entity from English law, something not generally appreciated overseas. And the Scottish High Court did come down with this remarkable judgment that it was unlawful for Boris to prorogue, or in a simpler word for it, to suspend Parliament, because he told the nation, and indeed he told the Queen, who's the person who officially agrees to the suspension of Parliament, that the reason he was doing it is that he needed the time to prepare his legislative agenda now that he was the new Prime Minister, and he needed Parliament to be in recess while he did that, because it would take him some time to get all the stuff prepared to put before Parliament. Whereas, in fact, the court agreed with the applicants for this court ruling that the truth was something very different. Boris wanted the Parliament suspended so it couldn't get in his way, and that's what the courts ruled. They agree that that's what they feel. The court believes that the Prime Minister committed an unlawful act by going to the Buckingham Palace and telling the Queen that this is why he wanted the Parliament prorogued or suspended. Now, the story doesn't stop there, of course, because there are other parts of Britain or the UK, I should say, where court decisions have been taken rather differently. English courts, lower courts than the High Court, but the English court have decided that it's not unlawful. He's perfectly within his rights to do this. And interestingly, and rather surprisingly, in Northern Ireland, a court decision has been taken there, which matches the English one rather than the Scottish one. So all of this is moving towards, maybe inching, but moving towards a decision by the highest court in Britain, which now, interestingly, after some reforms, is actually called the Supreme Court, in imitation of the American court. So in many ways, we're turning towards an American solution. American type solution for what would previously be a political problem dealt with purely in parliamentary venues.
It's just, you know, every time you turn around, there's a different. How
How much? Every time you turn around, there's something new.
It's like
on the Brexit front.
It's like an onion. You peel one layer, and then there's another, and you peel another, and instead of getting less intense, they get more. It gets more intense. So, how does this latest thing? How do you see it playing out?
Well, the English High Court. Not the Supreme Court, but the High Court, which is fairly high, a set of appeal judges, will judge on trying to align these legal judgments from different parts of the country, different parts of the United Kingdom, Tuesday of next week. And if they decide that Boris has indeed been acting unlawfully, then the honest answer is we don't quite know. You'll hear this answer from me and from other people, even closer to the action, all the time in Brexit. We are in uncharted waters. That's the phrase that keeps coming up again and again and again. Britain hasn't seen this kind of constitutional conflict between different branches of government in this kind of fashion ever before. I mean, there have been some splendid sort of confrontations in the past. The monarch and the parliament has been the most crucial central one for centuries, and it got resolved some centuries ago. But it took the English chopping the head off one king to achieve it.
It took a while.
But eventually we ended up with a constitutional monarchy, which is what we have now, which for a long time has been very, very stable. But that's not what we're seeing now. I mean, stability is not what we're seeing now.
But there are two things that I think people need to be reminded in the story, unfortunately, which is it's an unwritten constitution, and separately, the suspension of Parliament, I mean, effectively, how many days were actually chopped out of the schedule?
Oh, yeah, this is something that I try and stress all the time now. There's been a lot of hullabaloo about this extension, but the truth is, for all the outrage and the huffing and puffing, what has happened is that in terms of actual working days that they would have had available to themselves anyway, they've lost only five. Because as we were talking about this last week, much of the time between now and October the 15th, when they do come back to sit in Westminster, that's time that traditionally has always been devoted to party conventions, or the British equivalent of party conventions. We call them party conferences in Britain. It's not as crucially a crippling of parliamentary time as you might think. Although, the clock is ticking. I mean, every day is important, I suppose, because the overall deadline for Brexit, as you know, is Halloween. Now, your other point was, I'm sorry, I've lost it.
Unwritten.
Your
other... just that it's an unwritten constitution.
Oh, the unwritten constitution. Well, on that, I...
Which I think is lovely.
The other thing is that it doesn't, just because it's unwritten doesn't mean
exactly
that it's chaotic or in a way somehow inscrutable. I mean, it's a constitution which, as I say, has provided for an awful lot of stability for an awful lot of time, and it may not be written down in one single document, but it's full of precedent and established conventions of behavior and procedure. Everybody knows, it doesn't have to be written down for everyone to know what is constitutional, what is general constitutional practice, and that's how it's worked. It's worked until, of course, people decide to overthrow the normal constitutional procedures.
Until there's an outlier, and then
exactly, and doesn't that sound a bit familiar?
Yeah, but then you sort that, and the next time, There's a cyclical nature to the whole thing also, and you can
taking the broad view, that's obviously the case. We always get over these things, and then we've either learned from our experience or just choose to forget it and move on.
But there's
an extra piece of precedent established, and that's how our constitution in Britain operates.
Right, and you know, again, striking if you are just an overviewist, such as myself, would you suddenly take?
Well, me too. I'm 8,200 feet up today. So
I'm jealous.
That's
but that this is the first time it's been taken to the courts. And then people have to understand there are different courts, because this is where, you know, it's not just one country.
It's a united kingdom,
right?
Yeah,
and you know that. Nothing in there lends itself to current, in this country at least, press coverage. And with that, we can. Did you see anything from last night, or did you manage to stay 8,200 and so on?
No. I did my due diligence. I'm a media commentator.
Yeah,
I can't say I did it with any pleasure, but I did it. Yeah.
Yeah, that was 3 hours of your life you're never going to get back.
That's the great thing about me being me is I've already made up my mind, so I don't want to put a year ahead of time. I don't want to put myself.
You're a citizen, and you've got because, your own citizens' rights. I have this broader duty.
Right, and I feel as though
I have to beat the media. My column is called the Media Beat.
I don't consider them debates anyway. So that's my
point. I understand that point entirely. I'll take advantage of my 8,200 feet and say that one overview point that is pretty clear from the way it's been going. What we did get out of last night's debate is a much clearer sense of the differences between the candidates, which I think overall is a very good thing, because obviously Democrats have to make a choice. Democrats in the country as a whole have to make a choice, and that process is helped enormously, I think, by the different positions that were struck across the spread of 10 people last night. The other thing is that the needle has not been moved very much, generally speaking, about in terms of who it looks like the mass ranks of members of the Democratic Party, lay members feel. And I think now probably we're at the point where we will coast with a kind of stasis, you know, a position in which the static nature of each candidate's following won't be decided probably now until the Iowa caucuses, and that's when people will start to make their actual decisions, and that's really when we'll be confronting a much narrower field, and we'll be genuinely in the business of choosing the actual candidate.
So if you were in the media business rather than just the media beating up business, and I'm obviously
God forbid.
Yeah, exactly. No, and obviously I'm being facetious, but literally,
God forbid I was in charge of anything.
I was just going to say, if you ruled the world, because there we are. The Iowa caucuses are 5 months or something away, and
February, yes.
And the Brexit. Going back to that for 1 second, you're with Parliament suspended at the moment. Everybody is sitting there writing these moronic writing columns that that are
media beating going on your side too.
Well, never mind that. But I'm inspired by you. No, but there are these they're writing about nothing because they've got to fill the pages. Such as they are, I'm going to say record player in a minute, but they've got to fill the space. And if you ruled the media world here, we've got a similar problem, because until we actually get to a vote, we've 5 months from now, there's a lot of space. There's a lot of column inches once again too.
Oh, they'll be filled. Yeah, they'll be filled with lots of huffing and puffing, as I said before. Yeah.
And so the question is, if you ruled the media world, do we just have to basically accept
that?
Oh,
I don't know. What I would love to see is people running away from the battlefront for a little while and back into the weeds of policy making. I would love to see journalism devoted to analysis of the various policies on offer. The crucial debate on healthcare, for instance, simplified to the point of saying, do we continue and build on Obamacare, or do we opt for something more approaching Medicare for all? What are the actual virtues and demerits of that argument? Similarly, the immigration question. Well, across the whole range, in fact, gun control included. It's possible to just step back from the rhetoric, and do journalism. One of journalism's main jobs, which is to get to the background, get to the roots of each argument. Where is that going to happen? I haven't got the magic wand to make that happen anywhere. But I know the places where they're most likely to do it, and I hope that their example is one that more and more journalists follow in the months ahead.
And I will say that there is an audience. Hey, scaredy cats. Oops, sorry. More media beating. There's an audience out there for it. You have got people who would so welcome some cogent analysis.
You and I are not alone. I'm absolutely sure of that. Yeah.
No, absolutely. No, in this instance, and I'm not just saying, you know how it will sometimes be demographically specific, but it's not. It's the whole. It's a football field from young to old who would absolutely welcome some just way less breathlessness and a little more. Okay. Can this work or not? Which bit are you leaving out? Because that's
what do the taxpayer implications of this actually amount to? Those crucial questions, which we'll get flashes of in the debate context, and we'll get flashes of in political analyses. But if we had policy analyses, that would be so much more useful.
Yeah,
I know I sound like a terribly naive individual who whistling at the moon here, the harvest moon tonight.
Who listens to a record player?
Or listens to a record player to educate
himself. That's what you gotta love about. But that's what you gotta love about Uncle or Grandpa Joe. He slides into things that make perfect sense. Pardon me, it makes perfect sense, but just in a lingo that's a little removed from current lingo.
Except that what he was addressing at that time, and I'm not in defense because there were some moments.
There's nothing
where,
to defend at. I thought it was a fine comment.
There was, unfortunately, there was some Joe, some major Joe. There were some Joe moments, but what he was.
I think the kindest word was meandering. Is that right?
Close on. I am personally related to someone who used to do what we would call a monologue, and it was very much it's like, okay, I just got monologued by who shall remain nameless, but they you really had
Uncle Joe or Grandpa Joe took up more minutes than anybody else on the show. It's a convention that's established now.
The moderators
every now and again go on a little journey, and we have to go with him.
Yes, we do.
Talking about the minutes, a 3-hour debate. The person who had the most time because he was defending himself was Biden. He had a little right around 17 minutes. All the other major candidates had anywhere between 15 and 17 minutes, and then the lesser tier candidates. Now that's out of 180 minutes. The most candidates got to speak really on their own without defending themselves came out to about 7.5 minutes a candidate. without having to defend themselves. 7.5 minutes each in 2 hours or 3 hours to give proper positions about where you stand. That's where it's just so ridiculous.
Yeah. I mean, you're not going to get me disagreeing with that. I mean, of course it is. I mean, the whole thing is the very opposite of what you would call a political exchange of views. It was, I mean, we've gotten very used to this now, and I'm afraid getting used to it is part of, unfortunately,
part of the problem.
letting it become acceptable. But yeah, we've got a convention, a tradition now that this is what passes for political debate in this country, and it's a crying shame.
Oh gee, I was just going to say it's pathetic. All right, but that would be unfriendly,
crying
right?
Crying shame is better.
Oh no, actually,
I'm sorry.
Do you think crying? David,
crying
you can
shame.
Vote.
Well, I said it.
That's right.
It's a fine phrase.
All right. Well, then I'm going to vote too.
It's fake news. Fake news.
You may have to break this tie, Michael.
The
he
tie is
did.
Broken. The tie is broken. I'm with you, David.
Either way, it means the same thing. I'm being told.
It does. It's lamentable. And you know, the next obvious question is, what are we going to do about it? What are we going to do about it?
We're going to start a whole new, I know what I'm going to do, but we're going to talk about that next week. So continue to heal way up there looking down upon us, and we'll just do our utmost to sort things until you get back.
Oh, I'm glad. I look forward to that.
All right. Thank you very much, David Tereshchuk, The Media Beat.
And, of course, you can hear David here live on a Friday morning, rebroadcast on the weekends, and also
on, as you said, noon block on Mondays.